This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
Canada's Competition Bureau is suing Google, owned by Alphabet, over claims of anti-competitive behavior in online advertising. The Bureau announced this on Thursday, saying it has filed an application with the Competition Tribunal. They're asking the tribunal to order Google to sell two of its ad tech tools and are also seeking a penalty to ensure the company follows Canada's competition laws. In response, Google says the complaint doesn't reflect the highly competitive nature of the ad market, where buyers and sellers have plenty of options.
Concerns about the dominance of big tech companies has been steadily mounting for years, leading to an increased emphasis on the role that competition law might play. Following in the footsteps of the European Union and some U.S. actions, Canada's Competition Bureau has stepped up its activity as well. The government also expanded the toolset within the Competition Act by expanding the private right of access that enables individuals to launch their own claims. The Competition Tribunal recently addressed the first such case, primarily involving Google, with implications as well for Apple. Here to help unpack the state of the law, the tribunal's decision, and what it means for future actions is my colleague at the University of Ottawa, Jennifer Quaid. Jennifer is an internationally recognized legal expert and scholar in the fields of organizational criminal liability, corporate accountability, competition, and business regulation, as well as a senior fellow at the Center for International Governance Innovation, or CIGI. Jennifer, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Michael, for having me back. Glad to be here.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you back. And, competition law and certainly big tech has been a big policy issue in the U.S. and Europe for a number of years now. And lately, especially, Canada's begun to join the fray. And the reason to ask you to come on is that there's a recent decision from the Competition Tribunal that involves a private interest claim against Google that it seems like it may open the door to future claims, as a bit of a roadmap's been established. So I wanted to try to weave together several strands here, both this notion of private interest litigation or claims, this specific case, and then some thoughts about where things might go to from here. Why don't we start with this notion of a private interest claim? As I understand it, it's been there in the Act in very modest form for quite some time, but more recently in 2024, the government made some significant changes that are designed to significantly expand the scope and potential damages that might arise. So can you get us started by, I suppose, walking through the history a little bit of this provision and how it's gradually expanded?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. So what we call in the competition world a private right of access, which essentially is contemplating that private parties, instead of the Commissioner of Competition, can go to the tribunal to seek an order in response to anti-competitive conduct. That's been around since 2002, but in a very limited fashion. And for those who are interested, you can read some of the legislative history around it. But there was a lot of concern about opening up the potential for private plaintiffs to bring cases, because they weren't sure that was always going to be done for the right reasons, and was it really a good use of enforcement capacity. So initially it started out with just a couple of provisions in what's called Part 8 of the Competition Act, which deals with anti-competitive practices. It includes a whole bunch of different practices, but the ones that were given the private right of access are fairly exotic to most people. It's sort of exclusive dealing, tied selling. So these are practices that are typically engaged in by firms that have market power. So they have a strong position in a market and they're able to dictate certain types of conditions or certain types of behaviors that that are not always compatible with a competitive marketplace, usually because they lock in their customers or their suppliers in a certain way, or they restrict who else they can deal with. The initial way that this private right of access was set up was quite restrictive. So not only could you only bring it for a certain number of relatively specialized practices, you also couldn't get any money. So the basic idea was, instead of the commissioner bringing this case and asking for the practice to stop, you could go to the tribunal and ask for the practice to stop. But you had to have a stake. And the stake was pretty restrictive in that you had to be, affected, completely affected in your business. So your business had to be, seriously put in peril by the practice. And that was a high bar. So essentially, it was never really successful. And it was conceived of in a two-step process, and that two-step process remains, which is first you have to ask for permission to actually bring your case, and then you bring your case, and it's heard on the merits. And the tribunal historically was a very tough gatekeeper, and it was hard to get over that first hurdle, and there was never really any successful actions. There was one other major reform to the Competition Act in 2009, and at that time, the question of private access was come up, came up, and basically the decision was, no, we don't want more. We're going to leave it the way it is. And so it wasn't, there was not a lot of appetite. There was still this worry that it was going to be vexatious and frivolous litigation, and we don't want that. In 2022, the first crack starts opening up, and it's a big change where they said, now you can bring a case in cases of abuse of a dominant position, which is kind of the central anti-competitive practice, category that is most analogous to monopolization claims in the US. And so that's kind of in a world that was being dominated by really big players and parenthesis, big tech. This is the provision that was the most interesting. And so to kind of say now we're willing to contemplate that, that started to look, like, hey, there's some potential here. But it still was limited to businesses who were affected. And that limits, so it's not groups of consumers or, public interest groups who can come. It's you got to be affected, and you got to be affected in a major way. So what happens in the second, or really the third set of amendments is we make an ex huge expansion of where that private right of access can happen beyond abuse of a dominant position, essentially to include everything that's civil except mergers. And we suddenly do two other things. First, if you're an affected business, you don't have to be completely affected. It can be in part. So completely or in part. And the second part is we create a whole new avenue called public interest. And so not only is it now more practices, but actually different categories of plaintiffs can bring it forward. So that's sort of how we got to where we are now. And
Okay.
those new provisions came into effect a year after they were enacted. So they actually are almost like spanking brand new, less than a year old. They came into force on June 20th, 2025.
Okay, that's super interesting to hear that history and see how it's developed over the years. I'm curious about the various perspectives, especially most recently when we saw this large expansion. What were some of the perspectives of certainly big tech and companies? Who was arguing for it, and where did the Competition Bureau itself stand on some of these issues? Did they chime in?
So in the course of the process where basically the government took on the task of updating competition laws, there were two consultations. The first one was actually before any legislative bills were on the table. It was conducted by Senator Howard Whetstone, and it was actually focused more specifically on whether the competition laws needed to be updated for the reality of the tech economy, like the big tech, data-driven economy. And I'm generalizing here. There were about 30 submissions, and they sort of split roughly into those who said, and this is my caricature, go slow, status quo, and those who are like hipster antitrust. And those are both completely inaccurate labels, but what it means is some were like, we have a law of general application. Let's be careful before we start getting too particular and changing general rules. Let's see if we can adapt it. And maybe the problems are not as different as we think. And the other group said, no. This is new. This is a world where things are different and we need more adapted tools. And the private right of access sort of came into that, but not in a huge way. One of the questions was exactly, coming down to how much enforcement can we do? And could we stretch enforcement differently? And I think that what you found is there are those who were like, we got to be careful we don't have frivolous lawsuits, and that might chill positive developments in the economy, innovation, because companies are like, I don't know, if I get sued, I don't want to, that's going to be bad. And then there were those who said, no, we need to make sure that we allow others to step in and say, hey, this marketplace is not competitive. We need a competitive marketplace, and we need all hands on deck to encourage that. And that's against the backdrop of increasing worries about productivity in Canada, about business innovation, about investment in, these fast-growing sectors of the economy like tech. And they're like, we actually need to worry about it. And if others are willing to do some of the work instead of the bureau, we should be encouraging that. The second consultation was the official consultation done by ICED, so Innovation, Science and Economic Development. And what they the what comes out of that is essentially now there's like more than 400 submissions, so a lot more engagement, a lot more different groups who were maybe not traditional insiders of competition law, but you have sort of a similar split, which is there those are like, we got to be careful, we don't want to open the floodgates, and those who say no, we really need to recognize that there are others who are affected and that there are others who want to bring cases, and in particular the sort of the public interest side of like, why is it only affected businesses? If we're worried about competition, shouldn't those who are supposed to benefit from competition also be able to bring suits? The bureau is tends to be favorable to expanding private access. That's sort of, I'm generalizing, but they really want the ability to say, hey, others might be better positioned to take it. We can't take every case. We are already stretched and we need to focus on the really big cases and let other cases be done. So that's sort of how people came out about it. And it's not very surprising to see that the people who don't want too much expansion tend to be those who are already kind of well established. So more settled companies, bigger companies, their legal advisors, their economic advisors. But on the other side, you have SMEs, you have consumer groups, you have public interest groups, and you also have, representation from the tech community, but in more like the startup world, like the smaller players, the Canadian Council of Innovators, and so on. And they are also like, hey, we got to be able to create a playing field where we've got a chance.
Okay. I mean, really interesting to see the divergent opinions and how they played out, at least in as you suggest, two different consultations. So as you say, all of this leads to these changes, and we get our first big test case now that involves Google. Who filed the case, and what were they claiming?
So this case was brought very quickly out of the gate, so by a fellow whose name is Alexander Martin. He's a app developer based in Toronto, and his position, in bringing this suit against Google and then also against Apple, I'll explain the difference between the two in a second, was to say there's a problem with the fact that there's basically a monopoly in search, or a cat, almost a monopoly in search, that affects how I develop my products because I have to basically adapt everything I do to suit Google's algorithm. And, I can't have freedom to sort of develop other things, and there aren't other really options. And then his second sort of argument was to say, on top of that, an entity that would kind of have the chops and the money and the technology to challenge, that is Apple, they're happy to basically be paid off to stay out. I'm summarizing grotesquely. Now, to be clear, there has already a case that, in which these arguments are being made that was, filed and fought in the US and, is sort of way, 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 way ahead because they've made determinations. We're still sort of waiting for what the consequence is going to be on the remedy. But Mr. Martin says, look, the same thing's happening here. I want to bring a case here, and I'm affected, and I'm affected like many other Canadians. So his objective was to bring this case as a public interest case, and he's bringing it under two different sections of the Competition Act. One is saying Google is abusing its dominant position in search, and the second is to say that Google and Apple have an anti-competitive agreement. There's a separate section which doesn't really have a name. We just all call it 90.1, and saying that's an anti-competitive agreement where the objective is anti-competitive. It's basically to just divvy things up and keep this comfortable arrangement. So that's sort of the thrust of his arguments and where he sat. So he's basically trying to say, I'm a regular guy, use the internet for my business, but I also use it for me, but I'm really bringing this suit in the public interest.
Okay, interesting. So what's the response? Obviously, these arguments or these issues, as you suggest, are arising elsewhere. How does Google respond? How does Apple respond, given that they're brought into this by virtue of the agreement that they've got with Google?
So here I have to get a tiny bit technical, and I'm not even an expert on procedure, but it's sort of important to understand the decision afterwards. The way the private right of access works is it's a two-step process. You have to ask for leave. And so the decision that's been rendered by the tribunal last fall is on the leave. Like, can I bring this lawsuit? And spoiler alert, the tribunal says no. But why it says no and what else it says is important for the future. But what essentially you have to do at leave is you have to file your application with an affidavit that outlines the facts in support of your claim. And, other than that, it's not very detailed. And so there was a lot of speculation about, well, what's necessary, like, to get over that first hurdle? How much evidence do you need? What do you need to bring to bear? And the reason that that's important is that, unlike the Competition Bureau, private plaintiffs do not have the ability to demand information through the courts. The Competition Bureau has a power under Section 11 of the Act where they can basically go to the court and say, we need this information. And, then it becomes, if the court agrees, and sometimes they're contested, but if the court ultimately agrees, the party that has to provide the information is compelled, like it's a court order. They have to provide the information. Private party doesn't have that power. They're not at discovery. They're like at the beginning. So how do we balance that? Well, the first line of attack that Google seizes on, as well as Apple, is to say, this guy basically, files an affidavit that doesn't say much, and then he has a paralegal file an affidavit which just attaches 146 documents out of the Google proceedings in the US, and that's not enough. And, in fact, the court shouldn't look at it at all. So that's their first, their first attack is saying, there's nothing here. But then, what the bigger and the more significant, arguments behind that is to say, well, this is, we think that what is required to get through the gate is to basically come out with a prima facie case with, clear, cogent, and compelling evidence, and you kind of already have to have a theory of the case. So basically, as a private plaintiff, you'd have to know a fair bit about competition law. You'd have to have a fair idea of what kind of evidence is needed. Maybe you already have experts queued up. And it's only then that we could say that we can be sure that this isn't frivolous and, just you're throwing some mud at the wall and seeing what happens. We'll see that, the court will come back, with assessment of that. Interestingly enough, Apple is even more hardcore, and they argue even more strongly to say, this has got to be very, like, clear upfront. You got to put yourself into the analysis of the Competition Act. You got to basically show us that you have all the things you need to prove abuse of a dominant position and so on before we even get out the gate. The other thing that, of course, they didn't like is Mr. Martin was asking for the ability to get a monetary amount, which is something I forgot to talk about at the beginning. That's the other big change, is there it's possible to get some money. Just have to be careful to not call it damages, because they aren't damages. And they also attack, his ability to be the right kind of plaintiff. They question whether he's acting in the public interest or rather in his private interest. And so they basically, as you would expect, they're well-funded legal teams. They put every argument forward, but they want to shoot this down right out the gate.
No surprise. Before we get to the response from the tribunal to all of those arguments, does the competition commissioner intervene or provide some sort of perspective on whether that office thinks the case should go ahead?
Yes, and in this case, there was a fairly good reason to allow the commissioner to contribute some information. The commissioner's position in this case was only on the law and the interpretation of what the public interest prong of this private right of access involves, and they in particular were very attentive to making sure that we don't end up asking for so much at the beginning that the right is basically moot. Like, there's nothing, like, no one can make it out of the gate. So they take no position on the merits of the case. They only argue the law. It turns out, of course, that the arguments of the commissioner will be very important in the reasoning of the tribunal. And I think that's, credit to the bureau for intervening and for its legal counsel bringing those arguments forward. And I think in subsequent cases, we may still see a little bit of the bureau coming in. It depends, of course, how novel the questions are, but this was the first case, and clearly it helped, I think. for the tribunal to have that that position coming from the bureau. The other thing I should specify, again, I hate to get into the weeds, but at the stage of leave, the respondents have to ask for permission to submit evidence and so on. They obviously can respond to the arguments, but this is not a contested proceeding where you have a balancing of evidence. And so the respondents are actually quite limited in what they are, able to say, and then they have to ask the tribunal to authorize. That didn't prevent Google from submitting a lot of stuff, but just to say that, this is a pretty limited record, and the tribunal has to make these decisions. So the representations of the bureau were important in that context.
Okay, so those are some important caveats. That what we're really looking at here is fleshing out the rules coming out of the legislation and providing a bit of a roadmap for potentially future cases. So why don't we then get to what the tribunal has to say? So it's got this legislation. It's now got arguments coming from the companies as well as you mentioned from the Competition Commissioner as well. How do they interpret the provisions and how a potential plaintiff in the future, or well, in this case, as well as in the future, might proceed.
So the basically there are sort of two positions on the table, because even though Mr. Martin makes representations to start, they will then sort of rally behind the commissioner's position once the commissioner provides their more nuanced, kind of more fulsome set of arguments. And so on the one side, Mr. Martin, but also basically the bureau's argument is that we should approach private plaintiff public interest prong claims like constitutional and public interest litigation, and that there is an established set of criteria that come from the Supreme Court of Canada on that, that comes from Council of Canadians for Disabilities, Downtown East Vancouver, Downtown East Side Clinic, and there's a federal court decision in there too. I'm not a public law expert, but anyway, there's a trilogy of cases that are generally taken to sort of outline what it takes to take on to take on a case in the public interest in this constitutional public law context. And they basically say that should be the baseline, and from that we make tweaks, and the commissioner proposed some tweaks to sort of take account of the competition type context. The parties on the other side really don't agree, and they would rather see something that's much more similar to what the tribunal had kind of laid out for the what we call the affected business prong. So if you're a business affected by the practice, there's actually the criteria are more severe, and you have to produce this clear and cogent, compelling evidence. And part of that, and prima facie case, part of that is based on the fact that these companies, if you're being affected in your business, you have the evidence. Like, it's in your possession, right? And you're better situated to be more particular and to be more specific about what happens. You can provide your own internal corporate documents, and therefore you're not similarly situated to a private plaintiff. But anyway, Google and Apple will basically argue that no, we should be more close to that and not more close to constitutional litigation. What the tribunal basically decides is it mostly takes the plaintiff and commissioner's perspective, and it will say upfront, there's a difference. And I can go into they actually attach some importance to how the provision is written, and there are different words used to describe the affected business side of it versus the public interest side. And they say, look, the words of the statute, but also the nature of the proceedings, tell us that the leave test is going to be essentially applied differently. So, what are those criteria out of the constitutional litigation? They basically, come down to things that do make a lot of sense. There has to be a serious and substantial issue. You have to have a genuine stake, and you have to show that you've got the capacity to take the case on. So I'm summarizing, I'm not using the exact words of the court. And so for the most part, the tribunal is it, follows kind of what was proposed by the commissioner, but they do make some tweaks on the substantial and significant issue, and then also on the capacity to bring the case. In terms of the genuine stake, they tend to agree that, that should just be assessed as whether or not you're affected, and you can show that you're affected. And they're, I would say, more tolerant or more indulgent in that, particularly with Mr. Martin. But when it comes to whether it's a serious or substantial issue, they kind of break that down. Is it a genuine competition law question? And then is it a significant competition law issue? And, genuine means, is this something that really is about competition law or is it about something else? And what they're trying to avoid is, that you have commercial disputes or these are things that would be better solved, or framed as other issues. An open question for me is, what's their view going to be on that in relation to consumer protection claims? Because a lot of people imagine that private right of access is another consumer remedy, and I'm not sure that that's going to work. And so, to the extent you might have a claim under a consumer protection statute instead, will that, mean that some cases will not be characterized as genuine competition cases? Is this really about abuse of a dominant position, or is it about being abusive to consumers? If it's the latter, the court's more likely to say, hey, go under your consumer protection statutes. And there are division of powers reasons for that as well. But there's also, is this just a contract dispute? And, we're not in there. So it really has to connect to the concern of, like, does this deal with the functioning of markets? The second thing is it significant? So what's the question that's being asked? And is this something that rises to the level that, we need to, that the tribunal is actually in a position to deal with? And that has an evidentiary kind of tail to it. And this is where the tribunal first starts saying, yeah, and here's what we expect to sort of be able to get our heads around whether or not this is a serious issue. And that's where, of course, Mr. Martin will be found a little bit lacking. But, is this, do we have any material that allows us to make at least an initial assessment of whether this is a case that matters? Is this something that's important enough for it to do? And it, similar to the constitutional context, court resources are scarce. So we need to be concerned with that. Now, one thing that does tend to weigh maybe a little bit in favor of leave is that the tribunal is the only court that can hear these cases. That was a legislative decision. Not everyone agrees with it. Some people think the regular provincial courts should have also been able to hear cases, but they can't, outside of misleading advertising, where that's always been the case, and that wasn't changed particularly. And so, this is sort of, that's a bit of a concern, is that, what's going on here? But that may favor plaintiffs who are like, yeah, they can't go somewhere else. It really would have to be framed as a non-competition issue, but there aren't concurrent jurisdictions in competition. Then the other thing is, are you the right plaintiff to bring this case? Do you have the ability to see this through? And, where the tribunal goes a little bit beyond what the Bureau had been talking about in their submissions is they want to know whether they can actually have a proper contested debate on the question at the end of the day. And so they're not going to require that you have a prima facie case, but what you kind of have to do, and this is where the tribunal's giving hints, you need to have a plan. Maybe you don't have, 10 affidavits and, expert opinions and so on, because we're obviously at the leave stage, but who do you expect to call and what might they say? Who have you identified as potential experts to provide the kind of evidence you need? And so, actually, it seems like, oh yeah, they went the constitutional route, but there are some things that look a lot like, do you really have a theory of the case? Can you fit this into the Competition Act? And do you have the typical types of evidence we're looking for? And this is where I think, plaintiffs will have to, really scrutinize what the tribunal said here. And of course, the two other public interest cases that have been filed, they've both gotten permission to refile now that Martin has been, the decision has come down. And I think they're absolutely now going to go line by line through that decision and make sure that they've got themselves covered, that they're presenting their case in the way that the tribunal wants to see it. I mean, I actually don't know whether the tribunal decision will be appealed, but I've heard nothing that way. And I think the period is slowly coming to an end. So maybe it will stay that way. It's hard to know.
Okay. All right. There's a lot there. I mean, really interesting to, and I want to get to those future cases in just a bit. But before we do that, it does sound like there were those early concerns years ago about vexatious cases, and the tribunal, it sounds like, has some of those same kinds of concerns, and so is setting up a series of different guardrails in terms of need for a theory of the case. Can you see it through? Trying to potentially excluding certain kinds of cases on the grounds that it's is it core to competition. So it's trying to make sure that this is serious. Why don't we close the book on this particular case? You gave it away at the top that that Mr. Martin didn't meet the standard that they established. What was the rationale that they gave as they applied their framework to his particular case?
So a lot of it comes down to the fact that he went in, and I mean, that may have been the strategy also. He came in with, basically taking the American pleadings and putting them in front of the tribunal and saying, we want to run a case like this too. And when we get to discovery, we're going to get all this evidence that we need. The tribunal is prepared to recognize that the case, in applying, so, is it a significant and substantial, question. They recognize, yes, of course, this is, the abuse of a dominant position. This is a genuine, and it is really connected to competition law. There's no question. But where they're not so happy is, the type of evidence that's been put forward. At the end of the day, on this first element, do we have a significant case? They're prepared with some reluctance to say, okay, Martin kind of gets over this one, even though they go to quite a lot of trouble to go through all the stuff that he submitted and say, at the end of the day, there's only a very small part of what you put in that's relevant. And the tribunal will not do this work for you of like going through and finding out what was relevant. Like, you can't just dump the US pleadings in here. And they didn't dump them all. It's 146 documents or something like that. They said, we're not going to do that work for you. You got to tell us what's relevant. And when they sort of pared it down and they said, what are things that are actually factual as opposed to opinion? What are, conclusions of law? What are American things? It was a much smaller number of documents. So the message is pretty clear. Don't expect us to do the analysis work. You got to go through if you're getting. They don't exclude the potential that foreign judgments or foreign documents might be useful, but they do sort of say, they have limited use and you are going to have to explain how you're going to bring this case in Canada. So he gets kind of over that hurdle, but only very small on the first one. Then, they have to look at the question of whether or not he's got a genuine stake. And yeah, they sort of say, yeah, okay, there's a stake in here. And they're kind of willing to say you've got an interest in it. We're not going to quibble about the fact that you're also an app developer, and that you're also a consumer in some sense. But they are not overwhelmed, let's say, by Mr. Martin's position on this. And I think part of it has to do with the fact that because he didn't in his affidavit really articulate, like, how does this affect him? He just really kind of speaks in generalities. I think that they're going to expect far more specificity, even if you are representing the public interest. But the real sort of end of the road for Mr. Martin is on the third step, which is, is he the right plaintiff? Can he bring it forward? And they're like, look, we can't really assess your capacity. You really haven't put anything out there. You can't just say we're going to do it all at discovery. You got to have more than that. And I mean, what I interpret sort of between the lines when it says, you should possibly show us a list of witnesses or maybe some experts you've already retained, I'm like, oh, so you need some money on the table. You don't retain an expert for free. Now, maybe you don't need to have done a lot of work. But I think it's part of that concern about, whether litigation is really serious and not vexatious and strategic, and the court is very alive to the potentially strategic nature. Nothing like going after your competitors to try and take them down. But here they really, it seems to me like you've got to be prepared to put a little bit of money where your mouth is. The other thing that's the quote that I love out of this decision is that Justice Little says, look, even in constitutional litigation, this is not for the faint-hearted. Like, you have to be prepared to put in some work up front. And that's, I think, sending a message as well. And What I worry about, even though I can understand the reflex there, what I do worry about is it suggests that, especially since most of the cases so far are not being brought by competition, like specialized law firms. They're being brought by plaintiff law firms who do other types of plaintiff litigation. And, that's an area of practice. Will they have the reflexes to know, oh yeah, I gotta go and get myself a couple of economists before the defense goes and locks them all up, right? This is already a problem for the bureau, like making sure you can go and snag all the experts you need before they get conflicted out. And there's the world is not that big in terms of economic expertise and these witnesses for hire. And do you know how to frame, well, I'm going to have this witness who's going to say this thing because it's relevant to this point. It sort of presupposes a certain amount of knowledge, which, at the present time, when you consider how we're with new legislation, I mean, there are historical ways that these provisions have been interpreted, but a lot of them have been changed. And so what are they going to mean going forward? This is going to put pressure, in my view, this is my personal view, on the Bureau to, when it's publishing its guidelines, it has a couple of sets of draft guidelines out there, to really be mindful of the fact that historically those guidelines were, here's how the Bureau views its cases, and they were directed at potential defendants. Now, I think a lot of those guidelines will also be the first point of contact for plaintiffs who are like, okay, how do I get my head around these problems? And on that, I mean, there's a consultation going on, so I'm not going to get into that, but I have some concerns about the current state of the guidelines because I'm not sure they're helpful in the way that they could be. But acknowledging that plaintiffs are not similarly situated a lot of the time to the defendants there, how are we going to make available at least this sort of table stakes information so you can get through the door? I don't know. So anyway, Mr. Martin fails because basically he hasn't put enough on the table. He hasn't really got a plan. He's basically just said, let me get through the door and try. And the tribunal's like, no, that's not enough.
Which on its face sounds reasonable, although as you unpack all the things that are that the tribunal is requiring to be able to get through that gate, that's a pretty high bar. I mean, we're miles from the concerns around vexatious claims to the point that pretty legitimate claims require real resources, it sounds like, in a way that we don't see quite as much in Canada. In the US, you get any number of public interest type litigation and different groups that are better resourced for this sort of thing. I mean, this does raise the question as to whether or not we see that kind of capacity in Canada to be able to get over the kind of hurdles that we've just seen developed.
Oh, I agree. Two other, kind of mini points that are probably obvious, but it's not that easy. And that's sort of why they went and used the US information. It's not like Google's out there saying, oh, here's how we do things. You got to look for that information and you're not going to have access to it. So the fact that a lot of this stuff was made public, and it's, sometimes information that's not in Google's interest, but had to be made public. That's a way of actually being able to open the box and look and say, well, how would I even structure my case, right? That's the first thing. Second of all, I totally agree. The funding model for a lot of these public interest groups in Canada, they're it's precarious. And, taking on this kind of litigation, you got to be, I mean, it's true. It's not for the faint-hearted, but it's also not for the thin-pocketed. You really need to have deep pockets. How are we going to make sure that, those who might be in a good position to bring these cases, who have a genuine interest, and that would be often these public interest groups, how do we make sure that they are actually in a position to bring the cases we want them to bring?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that represents a real challenge. And when you talk about relying on some of the evidence that is brought in other cases, I mean, there are clear echoes, it seems to me,
Excuse
with
me.
some of the class action cases that we see in Canada, where you get claims that are launched in the United States and Canadian class action bar basically piggybacks on some of the same kinds of claims, relying on much of the same kind of work. It's certainly not unusual to see that at all. If you're being asked to develop entirely new evidence with no real way to compel that evidence, that's a real challenge. Why don't we conclude with this? Obviously, competition, we know that competition law, big tech, has been a focal point from a policy perspective. There's a lot of people, whether it's companies, individuals, we see from politicians, looking to find ways to try to rein these companies in to an extent. And I guess as we unpack this particular decision and the way in which Canadian law has tried to open the door to countering some of those activities and saying, well, we'll open the door to other groups besides just the Competition Commissioner to bring these claims. Again, it does beg the question, is this the way to do it? Will we see, do you think, in 3, 5 years' time, this being a regular tool that gets used and one that's proven to be effective? Or are the challenges here so big that at the end of the day, we're still going to rely very heavily on the Competition Bureau to lead the way on some of these kinds of concerns?
That's an important question to which I don't have the full answer. I would say that even, in the best case scenario where we start to see a successful pattern of plaintiffs who are able to get through the leave phase, and then we'd have to actually see these things on the merits afterwards, where it's possible and plausible to bring a case, it's never going to be a complete answer. And that part of that is because competition law has a certain ambit and is concerned with a certain number of things, and big tech affects way more than that. So in some ways, one of the challenges has been to say, well, big tech intersects with competition, but that's certainly not all that should concern us. And I do think that, part of the broader conversation has to be that you can't rely on one area of law or one type of recourse to address these things, particularly when you consider just the resources and the inequality of power that's sort of standard. So the Europeans have gone a certain way. They tend to be more legislation heavy and more regulatory framework heavy, and they also have a different structure, right? We can't have a Digital Markets Act in Canada. Like, that just doesn't work with federalism. But the Americans have also taken a different approach, and should that's something else. One of the things that many people don't realize is the Competition Bureau doesn't have an express consumer protection mandate. That is a provincial jurisdiction. I think consumer protection is something that's got to step in. I think there are privacy dimensions. Let's hope there's an update to privacy law. You know a lot more about that than me, Michael, but I think that there are parallel remedies that address different sources of problems are going to be important. There's no way we can rely on one thing. One other thing that I didn't talk about is that we also have to think about what are the incentives? And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's like plaintiffs have to bring cases that are not going to end up putting them in a worse position. And you have to think about, well, what are the amounts of money that they could get? They can't get damages, right? Damages are not part of this because it's also a division of powers issue, and in competition, there's a very limited damages remedy, and it's only tied to criminal conduct. It's something that can follow on if you find criminal conduct. When it comes to the cases that we're seeing now, what's possible for plaintiffs is to go after an amount that is equivalent up to the benefit derived. But there's a lot of questions about what does benefit derived mean? Many people sort of conventionally assume that's disgorgement of profits or the illegal gains associated with the anti-competitive practice, but it's far from clear how that's going to be calculated. And moreover, that amount will have to be shared with, in the discretion of the tribunal, with others who are affected by the practice. So it's very unclear for the plaintiffs even, like, what at the end of the day am I going to get? Can I even bankroll this litigation? How would I do it? And that opens a whole other set of questions, is that, do we have to then worry about litigation funding, other types of mechanisms that are maybe not as common right now? And, it does sort of underscore the fact that this is not going to solve all the problems. This is not a panacea. It's not going to be for everyone. And I really do think that Justice Little, in writing the decision in Martin, when he said it's not for the faint-hearted, he was very serious. It's a big undertaking, and it's going to take more than just, I think we have a case. It's like you have to be committed. You're going to really have to want to do it, even though it's going to be hard.
Yeah, no, I think you've done a great job of unpacking precisely why it isn't something for the faint-hearted. There were, I think, some amount of optimism as this legislation unfolded that this would prove to be a mechanism that would really allow for a far more robust competition law response to some of the concerns that we see. But this first case highlights that the door's certainly not closed. There's a roadmap for how to do it, but it is a challenging road, to be sure. And so I thank you for really unpacking what's very complex area and making it really understandable. And thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks, Michael. It's always a pleasure, and it was a lot of fun unpacking this this decision.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at lawbitespod, or follow Michael Geist at mgeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca, or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.